Blog Talk Radio.
Misanthropus was the first man found on the earth. That earth was the motherland, Africa. We know that without total understanding of what happened in the past, it would be difficult to relate to the future. We know that within the structure of the music, there should be a message, and the message should be truth. So now, we give you Africa, the center of the world.
We are always honored as a privilege to come in your home this evening to share information with you. Tonight we'll be speaking on political prisoners inside and outside America. Many times when we talk about political prisoners, we recognize these individual men and women, they have fought and made sacrifices to try to advance their people and humanity, and often they are the most forgotten. Now, I would figure that any just man, any just person will agree that just ideas should be supported by just principles. And if someone is willing to lay their line, their life on the line to advance our people in your cause, then they are worthy to be remembered and to be fought for at all times, under all conditions. So tonight we're going to do a tribute. We're going to talk about political prisoners and try to remember some of those who are still in existence, who are locked up in these dungeons, and to talk about what can we do to make life better for them, and if possible, how can we free them. So we have an all-star lineup tonight to discuss this matter. We can start with our first panel. We got our first panelists. We're going to ask Brother Haki Kamafi Wachoki to just briefly say a little something about who he is and what he does. And then we'll go to our next panel before we begin. Brother Haki, welcome to Africa on the Move. Will you please give our people just a general backdrop on who you are and what you do?
Thanks for having me, Brother Africa. Yeah, I've been involved in the struggle for over close to 30 years now. Currently, I'm involved with African Awareness. My focus is to build institutions to sort of redirect the thinking of young people. I think thinking is critical in terms of addressing a lot of social, political problems that confront the community. So if I understand that without proper thought, particularly manifested by young people, then there's no possible way, a conceivable way of change. So my focus is to the institutions.
Thank you. Next, welcome to Africa on Move. We have Brother Anthony Williams. Welcome, Brother Anthony.
Oh, revolutionary greetings, Brother Africa. Thanks for having me on your program tonight. I am an organizer for the All African People's Revolutionary Party, GC, which is an independent pan-African political party based in Africa, and our objective is pan-Africanism, the total liberation and unification of Africa under scientific socialism. And we are guided by our ideology, Nkrumah and Thuraism.
Thank you, Anthony. Next we have with us our Brother Lewis Wolf. Welcome to Africa on the Move, Brother Lewis Wolf.
Thank you, Brother Africa. It is really a privilege to be on the program tonight. My background in these issues relates to fighting against the death penalty, and we can discuss the nature of the death penalty, because for thousands, if not millions, of people inside the bars, behind the bars, they are on the death penalty, even if not officially so. I really feel that people have to understand that political imprisoners, virtually most people behind bars and prisons, wherever they are in this country and in many other countries, are all political prisoners.
Excellent. Next, we have with us Brother Mia Smith. Welcome to Africa on the Moon.
Yeah, Brother Africa, I'm glad to be a part of this. I'm, as you know, educator and an activist some many years, and currently involved largely in trying to get an increased attention to the need for education, our Africana education especially, and as well as the fight against militarism and imperialism. And so I find this particular subject very compelling, and I hope to be able to provide some insight along with others here tonight.
Okay, let's start out with this question. I'm going to give a backdrop with this question. We often say that power begins with conception. And when we say power begins with conception, many times those who are in power, they have the means and the ability to define what they want things to be. So when we talk about this concept of political prisons, different people have different conception and definition of what is a political prison. I would like each one of y'all in general, give us what is your conception of what constitutes a political prison. I'll ask you to take that question first, Brother Lou.
Well, the conditions in prisons are, by their very nature, a political status of all people, virtually all people in prisons. And so the fact that a huge number, a huge percentage of those behind bars should not even be there, or if they are there, they're not innocent of a violent crime or of a crime that deserves imprisonment. There are many people in political office today who should be in prison. And we could name some of them, but the point is that political prisoners are people whose rights have been stolen from them, who have been put there behind the bars for political reasons as opposed for reasons of what they call justice.
Okay, Brother Aki, how do you conceive this concept of political prisoners?
Yeah, I essentially, I see political prisons as people with conscience. People who dare ask the question cannot be a different paradigm in life. Often we have these systems which pop up certain sections of society while doing very little for the overwhelming number of society. And I think political prisoners' position is that, you know, that in the political world, it makes sense in terms of making sure everyone is can adequately participate in the political process. It makes for a better society overall. But, of course, the real resistance in terms of those in power is one of economics. And, of course, the more people that participate in society, then the less power you have, and the less opportunity you have to amass a lot of some of the wealth. And so that's an intrinsic resistance for those in power, to those of us who stand up and say, listen, we fight for a new paradigm, one in which, you know, all human life is valued. So I think political prisoners are people of conscience. And I think, you know, despite the will, desire of those in power to liquidate political prisoners by incarcerating political prisoners, you know, wholesale, this notion that somehow that you're going to discourage, you know, political activity, discourage those of us with conscience from, you know, proceeding with trying to bring about new paradigm. So they put simply, political prisoners are people of consciousness.
And for Brother Mayo, what would be your conception, definition of what is a political prison?
Yeah, well, I agree with all that, of course, it's been said, but look at simply those who are locked away because they're considered a threat to the imperial order, the U.S. imperial order, and the private property interests of the ruling classes. Simply these incarcerations, the arrests and imprisonments are in violation of international human rights law and international humanitarian law, both of which are slightly different. One deals with the general conduct of society. The human rights law and humanitarian law supposedly deals with war, and engagement in conflict, violent conflict. But in both cases, there's supposedly a protection of rights and a protection against torture. And these persons incarcerated in the U.S., that we define as political prisoners, are incarcerated in violation of these international laws as well.
Brother Anthony, is there anything you'd like to add to the definition that we have heard so far?
Yes. I agree with the points that were raised earlier. I would add that that a political prisoner is imprisoned because of his or her work or political beliefs that go against the politics of the ruling bourgeoisie in a capitalist society, to make it a little more specific. And what characterized political prisoners is that they're in prison because of their fight against the current political system, not so much the action that got them in, you know, encountered with the police in the first place, such as murdering, robbery, things of that nature, but because they asserted a different political belief system from the ruling class.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we just had another panelist join us. We would like to just welcome him briefly, Brother Jabari, and ask him just briefly give us a little backdrop of who he is and what kind of work he does. Welcome, Brother Jabari Robbins, to Africa on the Move.
All right, thanks for having me, Brother Africa. I'm Brother Jabari. I'm the resident youth on Africa on the Move, and I'm constantly a researcher, constantly sending out and disseminating information regarding topics relevant to the discussion brought forth on the show, and looking forward to participating on the panel tonight.
Okay, I'm going to raise this question, and I'm real interested in terms of, since we're talking about what makes a political prison, we're trying to see how we define this particular concept, because it's become very important in terms of when we begin to start developing strategies and trying to organize the masses in terms of how we can go about achieving victories of freeing our political prisoners. But I know that when the political prison movement and in movement in general, there is a belief by some sectors of people in the society that groups can be identified as political prisoners. For example, let me just put it this way. Can African people be viewed as a group as all being political prisoners, given the historical context of how we came here and how we've been treated? Brother Hackey, what would be your response to that position?
Very, very complex question, Brother Africa. As a group, I think in the sense that you African people can be perceived collectively as, you know, political prisoners, I think, I think you have to see it more.
I tell you what we do, Brother Hackey. We'll come back. Let us come back to you, and we'll move to Brother Luke. I'd like to get his response. Can we group groups under the concept of political prison? What would be your response to that?
You know, your voice is garbled. Could you repeat the question? I'm sorry, Lee.
Yes. In terms of, can we identify groups under the concept of being political prisoners? There's argument in this country that African people are all political prisoners based upon our historical history of being here and how we came here. So how would you deal with that position?
Well, today as we speak, there are over 2 million people in this country in prison. And, you know, if you break down by population group, by different groups, overwhelmingly they are people of color. I mean, far beyond overwhelmingly, it's well more than 90%. It strikes me that the case of racism is alive and well, that creates the prison and industrial complex. It's not only about vengeance against people who, you know, in many, if not a large number of cases, are innocent of the crimes for which they are charged. But the racism of the system makes it easy for the system to put them there, put them in prison. Secondly, of course, we can't help but notice the fact that prisons are now a huge industry in this country. And if you go to rural areas in the United States, prisons are the first and primary source of employment, and so it's very popular for some people to work in the prisons because it's a job, where there are in many cases very lots of unemployment. So I guess my answer is that it's about racism.
Brother Anthony, would you like to take a stab at the question?
Yes. I would add that it's about racism, but also there is a class factor involved here. And I raise that because unfortunately, there are some Africans, a small group, who benefit from the present setup. And I'm talking primarily about the African petty bourgeoisie, which consists primarily of the political officials, corporate managerial officials in society, and so the bulk of the people in prison, a majority, are the poor, not only Africans, American Indians, and Spanish-speaking people, but primarily poor people, mainly because they do not have the resources to fight against the judicial system effectively so that they can avoid being in prison. So there is a class dynamic as well as a national dynamic, in this picture as well.
Coming back to Brother Hackey and then Brother Mayor, and then we'll move on to another area. Brother Hackey, your response.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm not sure if a group can be defined as political prisoners in a category. I think that certainly when you're talking around economics, there's no question about it. I mean, you look at in terms of the function of the African community as related to capitalism. Clearly, you can make the case that we are colonized people in the sense that they determine labor patterns, whether labor contracts or expands, or they determine in terms of what extent our ability to eat or the kind of wages that we're privy to, or even whether or not we're going to find a job. So those kind of things are reminiscent of a colony. So I think certainly when you talk about the mass of African people in context of global capitalism, particularly in America, that in fact we represent a colony. So now in terms of the political factor, I think that to the extent that when we talk about things like access to jobs, quality education, access to affordable housing and so forth, those are political questions. And of course, the political decisions they make often are deleteriously impact on African community in the sense that they do nothing in terms of empowering the people. So clearly there is a desire among the ruling class in terms of making sure that we remain impoverished and unpowerful as possible. So I think that political character speaks to the actual strategy and the tactics employed by the ruling class to make sure to keep us in servitude. So I think to the extent that we talk about a political prisoner, in that context, we're certainly talking about African people being privy to all kind of positive that adversely affect our longevity and our interest in society.
And Brother Mayor, what's your response to the question?
There's hardly anything I can add to that, but this is all pretty well sums up what I feel about it, what I think about it. We are indeed, black community is a colony, and it operates just that way. This is, in effect, in some ways, the new Jim Crow concept, which kind of spells out some of that. It's not new at all, but it is in the more specific sense in terms of time. There is a reemphasis of policies that reflect on an earlier time of our period of colonization. So this is all that leads to an increased incarceration rate and an industry that benefits from it. I know in one of my own hometowns, a rural town in southern Virginia, that has had no industry since the days of cotton and tobacco, that now is replete with prisons, I understand, at least three or so, with some of them being the rail ends. The dead end of the train runs to the prison and in that community. And this is the source of income and livelihood for these rural people, largely white, but not only white folk, but part of this new increased prison industrial complex. So in that sense, your question is a yes, no. It's a bit of an exaggerated expression made to make a point, and the point is made. We are, even though that may be expressing it in a rather exaggerated fashion to make a very real point about a very serious and ugly situation that we're in.
Okay, we often say earlier that those in power have the right to defend. When you talk about political prisons, people may ask themselves, what political act have they committed? And what acts can you commit against a government that would be a political act and will make you become a political prisoner? What is the criteria of that, of defining what is a political act as relates to acts against the government? Anthony and Lou, would you take a stab at that first?
Sure. Could you repeat your question, please, to make sure I understand?
Yeah, what kind of acts one would constitute or qualify as being a political act that will make you a political prisoner? And who get to define that?
Of course, the ruling class would define it because they control the definitions that society uses. But let's see, in the context, for the sake of our context, an act of civil disobedience would be an example of a political act. Demonstrating against unjust laws or policies, demonstrating in support of a political prisoner or political activist that is struggling against the prevailing political economic system. Those would be examples of things that I could think of that would constitute something that would make a person subject to political imprisonment, as opposed to regular imprisonment like crimes such as murder, robbery, drug abuse, pimping, things of that nature.
Brother Lou?
I think that's a very, very solid answer you just made, but I think I would add anyone who stands up and points out the contradictions, points out the lies, the disinformation in this country that is so rampant at every level of government and of commerce, where somebody can become a millionaire and be totally corrupt and can be compromised seven ways upside and back and still be out there free, as it were, and continuing to function. The system is weighted against those who have a lower station in life economically and politically. Adding to the list that Comrade just made, I would just add that somebody who points out the lies and the disinformation, which is so frequent and so commonplace today.
Okay, with that definition or those definitions, let's talk a little bit particularly about political prisoners inside and outside the United States. Brother Mayo and Brother Haki, one of the most well-known political prisoners from inside the United States would be Mumia Abu-Jamal. What is so special about his case that make it a political, put in realms of being a political prisoner? And at the present time, how do you evaluate, what is your assessment of what is going on right now as it relates to him and the general political movement inside the United States?
Mumia, for example, is one of those we just mentioned, referred to really as someone who is arrested supposedly for a crime that the evidence shows is bogus. The arrest and conviction had so many holes in it, and there's been so much evasion and dishonesty from the justice system and the police authority. It's just clear to those of us who recognize it that this is a case of just any excuse will do. And so that's what you have with political prisoners. In addition to all the other general incarceration that I was really referring to with the train example and the growth of the prison industrial complex. But with the political prisoners, you have those who have indicated, as was mentioned earlier, by their work and struggle through their lives, that they are not inclined to bend to this political order, that they are freedom fighters, and they are dedicated to it, and they are effective at it, and therefore their arrests will be made on any basis in order to get them under the custody of the authorities. So what's happening now, and I'm not even really up to date on what has happened with Mumia's case. I know that he has moved out of death row finally after so many years, but still is in custody, and there is a movement. Much of what has enabled his movement out of off death row was by the force of people who protested and agitated worldwide. A small group, but effective and energetic, and that's what's necessary to deal with these cases. That's just the first minimal thing that's necessary to fight this stuff.
Thank you, Mayor. Hackey?
Well, strange enough, the whole definition in terms of terrorism is continuing to shift. At what point terrorism was a question of what you actually did concretely in terms of qualifying as terrorism? Now, with the revision of the statutes in terms of criminal law, terrorism is not only what you do now, it's what you think. So this is the real irony. So when we look at a case like Mumia Abu-Jamal, clearly, the evidence is very clear that he's innocent. But in fact, but the threat is what Mumia represents. He represents committed, articulate, you know, very good writer, ability to actually, you know, to impart information, to present it in such a fashion in which people, you know, want to hear more. And so, in terms of having that ability, that represents to the state a verifiable threat. And so, therefore, they want him off the street. Now, keep in mind that any time, for any reason that anybody's arrested, the first thing they want to do is to check their background out. And the whole notion in terms of, you know, long-term incarceration rate for people of conscience is not a flipping policy. It's one that's carefully thought out. And the whole notion being that if you can keep people in prison for long periods of time, some because of what they think, then you can deter other people, or at least that's what they think, from actually, you know, engaging in that kind of thought, or even thinking about the situation. I mean, clearly on some level it's going to impact on some people, but I think the overwhelming number of people that they will resist this notion in terms that the government's going to tell me how to think and what to think. But when you look at Mumia Abu-Jamal's case, it's very reminiscent of two other cases. One is Geronimo Jijaga Pratt, also allegedly killed a cop in California when the man was thousands of miles away. Even though they all knew that, the man was subsequently indicted and given a large prison sentence. Now, that says something in terms of juries. There's an old saying that most juries will indict a ham sandwich. There's some truth to that because of the overwhelming ignorance or the overwhelming lack of knowledge that it permeates society. And so, therefore, there's inclination among many people to believe that when the government speaks, that they speak truthfully. And even though you have many other examples in which the government lies, there are those in the society who still persist that when the government speaks, they tell the truth. And the second example in terms of the Mumia Abu-Jamal case is the brother down in Atlanta, Georgia, Jamil Al-Amin, formerly H.R. Brown. Now, one of the things was well documented, the federal authorities told him that if it takes us 30 years to get you, we're going to get you. And so what happened, when the situation arises in which something happens, they immediately went to pick up Jamil Al-Amin. They know he wasn't responsible for the officer's death, but that's not germane. But again, they was able to bring him in, convince a jury to grand jury to indict him. Ultimately, find a jury to convict him and put him in prison in Florence, Colorado, in a supermax for a very long period of time, and despite his medical problems that he's confronted with. So there's a notion in terms of, you know, that what you think is tantamount to terrorism is something I'd be very, very concerned about. And when I think about someone like Edward Snowden, in terms of the noble thing that he did, I mean, it's very noble for him to say, listen, you're getting away from the Constitution. Now, what you're doing is tantamount to criminality, and that no government should operate that way, because he understands that if the government operates in a manner that's criminal, then it loses respect, which breeds chaos and confusion and destruction. And so what he's trying to do is prevent that by exposing a little bit of truth. But unfortunately, this notion in terms of whistleblowers, which got its precedent back in 86, in which, you know, Congress agreed
that we want people to come forward and tell when things are wrong, because it simply makes government more efficient if people know, in fact, what the problems are. Obama has conceded that he doesn't want whistleblowers to exist, and so therefore he wants to penalize all whistleblowers for what they do. And so that speaks to a certain amount of repression, a certain fascist reality that confront the American people in terms of just what you can think, how you can think, or even what you can read. So people have to be fundamentally concerned in terms of the sweeping changes that are taking place and in the setting aside of the Constitution in terms of basic human and civil rights, which are being abridged. So I think we got to be very, very concerned about that and understand that terrorism for the corporate world is more a question in terms of what you think, not what you actually do.
Okay, let's talk about a little about political prisoners on the outside the U.S. To Dr. Lewis Wolf. Can you share with us people some of the political prisoners that you may know of, who they are, and talk a little bit about their history and their case?
If I may, just briefly about Mumia, it's ironic because my friend and housemate here, Joe Brown, attended a large demonstration against fracking, underwater use of chemicals underground, I mean, here in Washington, about 1,200 people. But maybe some listeners may not know that Mumia is in prison in a place called SCI Mahanoy in Pennsylvania, in a place called Frackville. I think the irony is quite revealing. As to prisoners in other countries, needless to say, the imperial state that we know and understand as it is today requires the emplacement of a repressive apparatus in every country that we claim to be friends of. Needless to say, that level of friendship is quite variable. But that's why the CIA operates in many, many countries and has for many years in a way to, part of its function is to create apparatus of torture, of repression, of imprisonment. And so we find that people by the thousands in countries around the world that in the so-called third world live in a state of minimal humanity in prisons that are even far, far worse than we can imagine in this country. I recall the case in Brazil where a prison, I think with, was it 8,000 men, all men, way much overcrowded. Suddenly there was a fire in the place and the authorities just walked away and let hundreds of these men be fried like meat. And they even, in later press reports, were saying, well, you know, it's their fault for being there and not our fault for letting them die that way. So, and in many cases, our U.S. policies create the conditions and for these prisons to exist. But I should point out that the cases of, like Guantanamo, like Bagram, and other extraordinary facilities that are now created by the United States, even built by the United States, as in the case of those two, where massive torture is well known to be in place, carried out in most cases by us, by the CIA, or by the military authorities. And so they always say that they don't need us to teach them torture, that whether it's in Pakistan or whether it was under apartheid in South Africa, or I would point out in Israel today, they know how to do it. They don't need us to show them how. But the fact is that the United States has a facility in Columbus, Georgia, called the U.S. Army School of the Americas. It was called the School of the Americas. It's now changed its name to Institute for, I can't remember the name of it right now, but they changed the name very nice sounding name, sounds like a wind sail or a big ship in the ocean. The fact is that they still teach torture there. We have the documents proving it. And so when we speak of prisoners around the world, we have to understand the U.S. connection to those prisons.
Okay. Brother Anthony, I notice your organization, the African People Revolutionary Party, GC, has been one of the few African organizations that I have seen inside the United States to have been taken a principal position on the Cuban Five. And they were five heroes from Cuba, and they've been incarcerated in these dungeons over here. Can you talk to people about what makes them political prisoners and what is the issue around the nature of their case and why they are so well known outside the country but very least known inside the United States?
Okay. The Cuban Five are five political prisoners that were initially sent by Cuba to the U.S. to report on terrorist activities by counter-revolutionary organizations based inside the U.S. against Cuba. What is not too well known inside the U.S. is that the Cuba has been waging a nearly 55-year war against Cuba. And it's an undeclared war, just as the Vietnam War was, but it does not make it any less real. And for nearly 55 years, Cuba has had to deal with attacks from various forces on the economic infrastructure of its country, as well as in addition to the U.S. blockade against Cuba. In an effort to starve it economically, so that in hopes that the people will turn against socialism. It has not worked to this day and will not work to this future, but the result has been it has made conditions very hard for the Cuban people. And in order to try to counteract some of the violence that was being committed against the Cuban people, and against Cuba's infrastructure, Cuba sent five men to the U.S. to infiltrate and gather intelligence against these terrorist organizations that were trying to terrorize Cuba by inculcating fear through violent means primarily, which would take too long to mention inside this program, all of the things that Cuba's been subject to. But they were initially sent, and they were, when they gathered this evidence and sent it to the Cuban government, which in turn shared it with the FBI turned around and arrested and prosecuted these five Cuban men for doing allegedly spying against the U.S. government, and doing intelligence work without registering, and some other trumped up charges. But they have been in prison for since that time. A couple have been released and have returned to Cuba, but there are three that are still languishing in jails in different parts of the U.S. and fighting for their freedom to this day with the support.
Brother Haki, you recently, not too long ago, went to Azania, South Africa, and you had a chance to maybe speak with some of the prisons, political prisons in South Africa. Can you talk about that conditions and why so many of the political prisons are still in jail, given the fact that they now have an African leadership in government, an African president, who was once fought side by side with these prisoners?
Well, one of the real ironies in terms of the whole struggle in Algeria and South Africa is the whole question around the land. The land question is one in which Nelson Mandela was prohibited from even discussing upon his release and subsequently after his release. But there are many political prisoners in Algeria and South Africa who take the position that the land question is paramount
and refuses to renege. And so, therefore, they continue to persist with the land, which is for the government on their side. And so, therefore, until there is some type of acquiesce among political prisoners to the whole question around land, until they give in to the land question, then they'll probably remain incarcerated in South Africa. So this is the problem that's going on with South Africa. And clearly, when you're over there, in terms of the level of poverty, the level of destitute, it's just the level of how destitute the people are. I mean, it's actually proliferated. I mean, there's more poverty in the world, you know, during the apartheid years. And so the situation has become extremely grim, and so the people are losing hope in terms of real change coming to South Africa. The ANC, by and large, is extremely corrupted, and at least some of the leadership is extremely corrupt. And therefore, the realization that there may have to be a neo-colonial struggle in South Africa is becoming very, very clear to Africans in South Africa.
You know, when we talk about the political prisoners, and I can address this question to Lou and Mel, and then I'll get to my youth. Brother Zabari, just hold on. We're coming to you. Brother Lou, I know you mentioned something earlier about there's a relationship between political prisoners and the death penalty and how it's been used as a tool. Will you speak just a little bit about that relationship?
Well, the death penalty is what it is. In this country, it is, the United States is the foremost practitioner of the use of the death penalty by far. And in some cases, just last week, I think there were four executions on one day, if I'm not mistaken. I think that was in Georgia. And so we see sort of on an industrial level the use of the death penalty. Needless to point out that many of the people, and we know this for a fact, many of the people who are on death rows around this country are in fact innocent of any crime for which they were charged. I have a friend who's been on death row for 34 years at San Quentin, his name in California. His name is James P. Anderson. And your listeners are certainly entitled to contact him. You just look up online, and there's a website for him there. He's an artist. He's like Mumia. He's a very intellectual man, a very cerebral man. And I go and visit him together with others every year, and I'm going out there in a few weeks. My point is that James is innocent of and has been 34 years in prison for allegedly strangling two women. The two women were strangled, but it was not by James. And he knows exactly who did it. The trial was a complete fraud, in a whites-only jury in Los Angeles. And when I talked with him at the prison, I asked him a couple of years ago, how many people here are innocent? And he said, well, of the 670 prisoners, or death row, it's entirely death row where he is, the whole entire, that part of the prison, it's the C block. Out of 670, and he went completely quiet for about 20 minutes, counting on the fingers of two hands, and he knows the cases intimately, though he doesn't know all the people in person. He's like a jailhouse lawyer. And he said, about 10% are in fact innocent. I dare say it's probably more than that. But the point is that that's the case around this country. People who are in prison, who are, executed, in many cases we now find out that they were innocent of the crime. Let me just last mention Troy Davis in Georgia, who was executed allegedly killing a police officer. The ballistics proved that he did not kill the officer. But that didn't stop them from executing him. On top of the execution, and I learned this personally when I attended his funeral in Georgia, in Savannah, Georgia. I was there in the church, and I met his sister, Martina, who some of your listeners will remember was campaigning for his for his pardon and not to be executed. And she and he both believed that she would die because of her breast cancer before they killed him. Well, it turned out to be the other way around. And so at the funeral, and this is a very instructive story of what happened, she said, let me tell you what they did. They took his body from the execution chamber, they put it in an ambulance, drove it 80 miles to Atlanta from the prison, at which point they conducted an autopsy to allegedly determine the, quote, the cause of death. Then they put him back in the ambulance, or the hearse, I think it was, drove it another 70 miles to his home in Savannah, and walked it up the steps and handed it to the family, his remains, and they handed her an invoice for this whole process. Can you imagine? This is fascism. There's no other word but that to apply here. So I think the death penalty, we all must, whatever our politics, left, right, or center, we have to find a way to abolish the death penalty in this country.
Brother Mayor, we'd like to stab at how you see how the death penalty has been used as a tool to punish political prisoners, and the issue of just in general when you talk about prisons being dehumanized, how they dehumanize them, the whole condition of it. How can we address that to improve it?
Yeah, it's a general situation. I think there has been probably more less of that with political prisoners in terms of death penalty than with the general population. It's almost as if the political prisoners have been left to languish and in bad health as a kind of a lesson to the public. No quick elimination of them, as with even some others, less political inmates. But I think that is more in the area of torture than actual death penalty. So we have a group. One of the criticisms that I've seen, I've not noticed it myself, but I've seen of the text, the new Jim Crow, was that it did not deal with the issue of political prisoners, as such, it ignored a very serious aspect of our current reality. So that's something that's it's definitely a special case. This is something up beyond the general incarceration. But one comment I wanted to make earlier, didn't the brother mention the School of the Americas? It's another kind of a death penalty, not an incarceration death penalty, but a launching of the state's death penalty on people who are not incarcerated around the world. That School of the Americas has changed its name. It's located at Fort Benning, Georgia, in Fort Benning near Columbus. And it has changed its name to the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation. And as the brother said, that's a very non-threatening type of name. But this place has trained people who were involved in the murder of the radical Catholic priests and nuns in El Salvador, and to the training the Contras in Nicaragua. It specializes in assassinations and the like. And it continues to operate on that basis. So we have that kind of thing operating in addition to this political prisoner situation.
Okay, we're going to now focus our attention to our youth representative, Brother Zimbabwe. You've been waiting for a while, Brother Zimbabwe. What would you say to, what do you think is the general status of this whole question of political prison movement inside the U.S.? How would you, what are some of your observations of what you have seen so far?
Well, coming from a media studies program, I notice a lot of times when this issue comes up in the media, you hear things like these people are criminals, you know, they're not worthy of being called human, you know, they're evil. It's always this malicious intent in describing them, and I think that's because they don't want people to find out the truth, because once the truth is found out, people are responsible, and people can be aware of the mass injustices that happen time and time again. Because, I mean, I look at the case of Brother Jamil Al-Amin. It's incredible. This brother is 70 years old, and he's always been a peace advocate, and they put him in solitary confinement. You know, he's isolated. You know, he's in this dreary dungeon-like area. And plus, he has failing health anyway, so, you know, that wouldn't cause him the chance of him expiring. And I know there's a movement to get him to get proper health care, but it's almost like they're trying to expedite the expiration process for him to be in those conditions.
Okay. We'd like to let our listening audience know that you are listening to Africa on Your Move. As your host, Brother Africa, we are dealing with the issue of political prisoners inside and outside of America. We'll be taking a 2-minute station break. When we come back, we'll be opening up our lines at 323-679-0841. That's 323-679-0841 if you have any views or comments, or if you'd like to talk about a political prisoner that you work with that the public may not know about. Please share that with us. We are giving our props and want to acknowledge the political prisoners, because they are often just disappear from the map of this world. And we know that's because corporate media does that. They have an interest to do that. So we're going to take a break. We'd like for you to call in. But when we come back to our panelists, I would like for y'all to think about this question, and I'd like to get a response, because we are talking about political prisoners. And the question that Brother Peter Tosh asked a long time ago. And he stated that everyone is talking about crime, but tell me who are the real criminals. So think about that. When we come back, we'll continue. You are listening to Africa on the Move. As your host, Brother Africa. And that's why we must speak truth to power. Right now we have taken a station break. The phone line is open. Please call it at 323-679-0841. We have a caller that's been waiting. We'll go to this caller first, and then we will come back after this caller to my panelists. I would like for y'all to respond to that question. Everybody is talking about crime, but tell me who are the real criminals. Caller, welcome to Africa on the Move. Caller 4381. 4381, you're on Africa on the Move. Your question or comment, please. Hello, caller. 4381. Are you there, Sister Hattie? Okay, let's go to the next caller. Caller 4298. Caller 4298. Welcome to Africa on your Move. Your question or comment, please.
Yes, good evening, and it's a great panel, and good to be on your own. My name is Brother Robert Moses, and there is a real good book out called Shackled and Chain, Mass Incarceration in Capitalist America by Brother Eugene Perrier. And this analyzes the growth of the prison industry and the political economy and the politics which developed it and nurtured it and made sure it happened in order to keep the working class off its proper role in society and to divert it and keep the ruling class in power. And so, but anyways, this is a good book. I think it's worth reading. It has a number of political prisoners in there, including the Cuban Five and Abu Jamal and different other political prisoners. I think it's a good analysis, and it takes up more than we have time to do right now. But anyway, it's a good book.
Thank you, caller, for your information. We now go to our panelist, starting with Brother Haki, in response to my question. Everybody talk about crime, but tell me who are the criminals?
You know, I like the old Chinese proverb which says that governments create the crime, criminals carry it out. There's a realization that policy definitely affects the way people behave. It affects people's perceptions. It gives people hope, or it may not give people hope. So it all depends upon the kind of society that you want to create. In America, those in power have opted to create a society which is unjust and unfair. And, of course, in creating a society that's unjust and unfair, it's going to be chaotic. It's going to be immensely violent, and it's going to be extremely sectarian. So this is a problem in terms of American society. You have all of these competing interests. And the bottom line is that, you know, in this society, this capitalist society, this notion that in terms of, you know, it's all about the bottom line. It has a corrupting effect on the people. It doesn't just impact on the ruling class in terms of corruption, but it filters down to everyone else in society in terms of being corrupted. So this the kind of individualism that's facilitated as a result of capitalism makes it, it affords us the opportunity to actually work together to try to change the paradigm where people have access to all the things they need in terms of being human beings. So it's a struggle in terms of humanity. It's particularly difficult in the context of capitalist America when you think about only six organizations which are all the news that you see in print or media or TV is controlled by six organizations. So obviously, they are very, very precise in terms of the kind of message that they create. Being consistent with that message and convincing people that, in fact, this is reality in terms as they know it. And so this is the paradigm that we face in terms of trying to bring about real change in society. So when we talk about real criminals in society, it's very, very clear that when you talk about not just ruling class, but you talk about a corporate structure, which is immensely criminal. I mean, when you get to a situation where the basic necessities of life, water, are denied people because of their inability, quote-unquote, inability to pay, it doesn't speak well in terms of in terms of the human existence. To say that some human beings operate on a level which is almost demonic underscores, you know, just how perilous the society is in terms of the overall impact on its populace. So I think that when we talk about criminality, it's very, very clear that when we talk about criminality, we're talking about the ruling class, we're talking about the corporate structure in terms of, one, dividing people against each other, secondly, perpetuating racism so as to ensure that people take sides against one another, exploitation, ruthless economic exploitation in terms of ensuring a large number of people are unemployed, so the people that you do employ, you pay them very poor wages, and knowing that they're going to accept those wages because if they complain, they simply get rid of them and go to the next person. So when we talk about criminality, there's no question about it. The whole system is criminal. In fact, when you go back to the history, the evolution of the country, in fact, when you look at it in terms of the stealing of lands, you talk about the subjugation of a people, the indigenous American, Native American population, and subsequent subjugation of African population, or even the male treatment of poor white people, then we understand that the nation in terms of criminality is very clear. Then when we talk about the real criminals, then we talk about corporate America, we talk about the ruling class.
Anthony, anybody talking about crime, tell me who are the real criminals.
The real criminals are the ruling class of this society, the bourgeoisie, and their agents that work in their favor and do their bidding. And I'm referring to those corrupt intellectuals who, for a few pieces of silver, sell out the masses of our people, regardless of what their ethnicity are. And let's see, a lot of what Hakeem said earlier is correct. I would add that this system is built on lies, and lies and repression, and that's why we have so many prisoners in the prison system today. And people who express dissent in terms of what's going on, they're persecuted politically. And that's why there's so many political prisoners. Now the mass of the people are lied to, so a lot of us don't realize that there are political prisoners in this society, because a lot of times they're convicted on either things like murder of a policeman, robbery, something of that nature. And the people are being lied to as a result. And that's what, this society is hanging its stability on. And something that Haki said earlier about this, the emphasis that this society gives on thought control, it is a sign that the U.S. has moved from the welfare state to fascism. But most people don't realize that, and partly because the way we think is being very tightly controlled for the most part. And people who put up a resistance to that are persecuted and made examples of. And that is why political prisoners are treated as harshly as they are, because they're being made an example. If you don't follow the line of the bourgeoisie, then all these sorts of torture and difficulties will come down on you. And it's a method characteristic of all dictatorial states, most recent being Nazi Germany and a host of these neocolonial dictatorships that exist around the world now.
Mel, I think one of the things when we look at any society, particularly this one, we recognize that they do an excellent job of dehumanizing the individuals and make the victims look like they are responsible for their own realities. when we say earlier they create the conditions for it. And this is very important because I want you to at least speak to why is it that when you become a so-called prisoner or one who is incarcerated, you lose all your human values as a human being and you're allowed to be treated any kind of way, even worse than the animals. How could we get to such a state where they openly can create human beings like that and there's no real serious response from the general population, particularly those groups in which where the individual comes from?
A piece of that, I think, is one.
Maybe ask me a response to it, Anthony. Maybe give me a first response.
You're directing that to me, Brother Anthony?
Yes.
Yeah, well, we have such a combination of factors upon us, including all that the brothers just elaborated upon. Of course, going all the way back, Africa slave trade, the Atlantic slave trade, and its actuality as a business adventure by the Western powers and the folks who engaged in that certainly had to change some of their views as so-called Christians, for example, and as so-called human beings, in order to carry out that practice and develop a system and a philosophy backing it up that allowed them to run that for hundreds of years, in addition to the genocide committed upon the native people, who in many cases welcomed them as human beings. And in the case of Virginia, my birth state, the native people saved these persons, these Europeans, from starving during their first arrival on this continent. Let's see. So from that, you get a situation today in which what I call the New America Cathedral is the casino. The casino for gambling and trying to win quick riches has become something of such a high value in American society. And I shouldn't say American, because we use the term American too loosely and incorrectly. U.S. society, I'll say, is where America is this whole Western Hemisphere. So I'd say particularly in this U.S. society, this materialism has reached a point where we have the New America Cathedral, which seems mayors in many cities that are struggling for revenue can only have one idea about how to raise revenue, and that's to bring in a casino, which is, I think, an indication of how bankrupt, not just in the financial sense, but in the moral sense, and in the sense of social justice that we have become. And so I think all of these things are upon us, and this is what allows the continuation of the incarceration for opposition, political opposition to the system. And this is a threat to the powers that be, and it is a considerable threat, one of the greatest threats to them. Therefore, the propaganda machine is in operation, just as was mentioned, and all of that to continue this system, continue the so-called might and the so-called nobility of this criminal enterprise that's the United States and its Western relatives.
Brother Zimbabwe, how do you deal with this question of this dehumanization of people who have been incarcerated and its ability to allow them to do whatever they want?
Well, you know,
and then the response from the public.
I liken it to how we were conditioned to think of that one particular kid that would be putting time out 1 year in elementary school. You know, he's supposed to be subject to mockery. You're supposed to make fun of him. You know, you're supposed to learn from example. You don't do what he did. And when I see that even though we're adults, I still see that same principle because that's the thing. We oftentimes are told to frown upon those incarcerated, but how many of us are careful to evaluate the fact and take time to find out what was the situation that put this person in this particular predicament?
Okay. Brother Hakeem, this man's incarceration issue and his relationship to not a political prison but people in general, this whole question of mass incarceration, many people see that as a form of war, act of war. How do you describe and categorize this phenomenon of this mass incarceration, particularly as it began to have an impact on African people and people of color?
Well, to the extent that it's a war in terms for maintaining control. The capitalist plans are very, very clear. You know, with the disintegration of the economy, as it continues to unravel, they understand that inevitably that's going to lead to a larger number of people who don't have access to jobs, in particular, you know, African people. So they're very, very clear on that. Now, to have all these people, you know, who don't have access to job and no access to hope, then clearly that they understand that it poses a threat to the stability of the system. And so, therefore, something has to be done in terms of to address that issue. They have opted, as opposed to changing the economic policy to incorporate the needs of large number of citizens, and has opted instead to incarcerate large numbers of people. Now, the problem in terms of the large incarceration rate of people is that it's not sustainable. Currently, you have 2.5 million people who are incarcerated. Even with the advent of private prisons themselves, you know, it's not economically viable in the sense that, one, you have to feed the people. Even if you feed them the same thing every day, the cost continues to escalate when we think about the level of inflation in society. Secondly, that riots are inevitable in these private prisons given the conditions, the horrible conditions that the people are subjected to, which is going to inevitably cost the system a lot of money. So this notion in terms of mass incarceration of people is one that's unattainable. It won't last for long. It won't last forever. And so this is the fundamental problem they have in terms of incarceration of a large number of people. Now, if we realize that incarcerating a large number of people is unsustainable, then what option does that leave the government in terms of addressing all these people who have access to jobs, decent wages, or home or shelter? What options are available for the government? Well, under the National Defense Authorization Act, which Obama signed into law, it existed during Bush's administration, but Obama signed it into law a couple of years ago. It was already law, but he extended it. Under the National Defense Authorization Act, this whole notion in terms of, you know, building concentration camps to intern large number of citizens in order to maintain stability. I maintain at the point that you start interning a large number of people, you know, in the society, it essentially is all over for this country. So irrespective of what they do to a large number of people that they incarcerate, it essentially is over for this country. In the sense that the world begins to see America for exactly what it is, and then the world begins to understand that to pursue policies which are unjust, unfair, and inequitable, that inevitably it leads to this kind of wholesale destruction of society. And so therefore, most governments around the world will take a look at America and say, listen, we better change course. But I think to some extent that's already happening. When we look at the BRIC nations, you know, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, they have already opted to make some economic moves in terms of, isolating the United States. So as we know, the dollar is the world's currency in terms of trade. They're opting to change that paradigm and create some other currency. Even when it comes to Russia and South Africa, China and South Africa, they're actually using their own currencies of some say trade, cutting out the dollar. So therefore, we understand that this system is not sustainable. And locking up large number of people is not going to change the economic realities that causes society, this economy to deteriorate in the first place. So large numbers of incarcerated people, you know, it's just merely indicative of the decline, the social decline of the society.
Okay, I believe we have a call on the line. We can open up a line, which is 323-679-0841. We call last four numbers and your question or comment, please. Caller number 4381. Caller 4381, you're on Africa on the Move. Your question or comment, please.
Well, I think this is a great conversation. And simply put, you guys have been just on everything correctly. And I am really excited about what you're doing, but I think the whole essence, too, and I really like what the other panelists said. One of the panelists talked about, you know, what do we do individually as people to get that person where they are? And so I think that really needs to be pulled out and talked about a little bit more, because I think sometimes we are our own worst enemies, those of us who are fighters and try to do and make a big difference in our communities that we come from. So I think we have to really look at that, reflect upon that, and think about that in a very, very deep manner, in a very, I guess, intellectual construct as well as a practical, theoretical construct. I mean, it's there, but then how do we really anticipate some successes from a discussion around that issue of what do we do to get people in as political prisoners ourselves?
Okay, Carla, I got you one more time. Centralize your major point again. What is that you want to raise one more time with us?
The central theme is someone talked about, they gave an example, one of the panelists, on, let's say, the child going into timeout. What did the rest of the children in the classroom do, in essence, to help that individual get there in timeout? And so the central theme is what are we doing for our to help people become political prisoners, not necessarily those of us here on the phone, but those of us as a group of people, the poor, or those who are the sellouts, those who are the ones who are afraid and won't speak up. You know, what is it that we can do? The central theme is how can we talk about that more and ferret out some constructs to change that.
Okay, caller, still on the line. We'll put you on hold, and we'll come back to you later. We're going to try to address your question. Okay, to our panelists, y'all heard the question. Brother Anthony, Brother Mia, and then Brother Haki. I think she raised the question. Where's the role of the people? What has the people done to allow these people to be political prisoners? And how do their action dictate either their success or their failure in terms of protecting them or being complicit in allowing it to happen? So, Brother Anthony, start with you first. How would you respond to it?
Okay. I would say the key in terms of turning the situation around is that, and I want to say up front that historically the AAPRPGC has always supported all of our the release of all of our political prisoners, those well-known and those not so well-known. And let's see, I think there has to be a greater degree of education around the causes that these political prisoners fought for one thing. For example, let's see, a lot of these people are in jail because they fought against the ideas of capitalism. So we have to intensify the education of our youth, especially around that. What you know, the stance they took, some of the mistakes that our organizations may have made. All of that has to be laid out. And I think education and communication is critically important, and we have to, you know, and that's what we have to do. And in addition to continuing the protests and demonstrations to get more support to deal with the conditions that our political prisoners are suffering from right now, But the long-term solution is political education of our people. That has to intensify.
Reverend Mayo, would you like to address that question?
I'm not quite sure that that's what the sister was asking. I was not really clear about it, but I'll follow a brother here in that education is necessary, and with the education, political education, community education is organizing groups for action groups, and at the very least, energizing current groups, existing organizations and groups, to get on their agenda this matter, and to take some action to inquire and apply pressure. For example, groups such as the reparation group in COBRA or others may be contacted. They may be involved with this or not, but should be engaged in it. Another example is the National Black the National Conference of Black Lawyers has been involved in something at the United Nations called the United Nations Universal Period Review. And this is a process, apparently it's introduced about 2006. And it allows community-based organizations to get into the process and point out to human rights issues regarding violations of international law, UN treaties, etc. Now, I don't know what has happened with that, but the U.S. was supposed to respond to the last, and I'm not sure whether it was the last one, but in 2010. So we need to get involved in those kind of things, find out what's happened, make that kind of information available to our communities, and get involved in the processes of putting pressure on through organizing. Okay.
Brother Hackey, before you answer the question, I'm going to try to see if I can clarify my understanding of the point that the sister raised, which I think is valid. The analogy that Brother Jabari used about the classroom student who being put aside and being ridiculed in front of the rest of the students, being used as an example, that you don't do what he do, don't act like him or else this will happen to you. I sort of think that's a connection between our political prisoners, those who have been incarcerated for political activity, conscious political activities, versus the masses in terms of their relationship with either responding to support them or not responding and acting out in apathy in terms of like there's a disconnect. You know, a lot of times people cannot do no more to you when you have organized base, when people are active, when you're engaged, and that's a connection between those who are acting on the behalf of the people. They're going to benefit from it, and those who are supporting the action. So with this question of apathy, we're in our society, we're in our community. Do we contribute as much as the reason why they are in that condition in? For example, I can guarantee you if a Zionist terrorist commit an act in the interest and honor of Israel, you will see that he will have the support of his community throughout, and there will be a totally different response. So he will not be viewed nor will he be treated in the same capacity. So I think that's the kind of analogy she is raising that has some legitimacy. What is your response to her question?
Well, I think what you're alluding to is a social process, a socialization process, which conditions us to be the way we are to a large extent. I think when you generally look at crime, one of the reasons why crime is so important to the ruling class is that it created an us versus them paradigm. So therefore, the others are someone you shouldn't strive to be like. So consequently, you got a situation where you got brothers and sisters going to prison, you know, taking political stands. The masses of people don't necessarily see that as heroic. They may see it as criminal. They see it as outside the pale or somehow un-American. But that speaks directly to the socialization process that afflicts our people, which begs the question in terms of just how important
education is in terms of redirecting the way our people think. Now, whether or not our people are receptive to certain kind of information is also questionable. But the only thing we can do is continue to say it over and over and over and over again until they get to the point where it begins to resonate, where it begins to make some sense. But in terms of you know, that fear factor, you know, there is no science in terms of, you know, eradicating fear that exists in the minds about in the hearts of our people. I mean, there are no magic bullet. There's stuff that you can do in terms of, you know, encouraging people not to be scared. Fear is a very intensely and very individualistic, intense kind of thing. And those in power understand that by instilling fear, they automatically they can exclude a large number of people in terms of political participation, simply because of fear. So there is no silver bullet in terms of how you go about remedying this question in terms of why people are so afraid. Now, in terms of, you know, when we talk about support, support is very important, you know, in terms of particularly for political prisoners. One of the things that I recall that when December 12th was on trial about 10, 12 years ago in Manhattan, there was great community support for the December 12th movement. And as a consequence, and all these officials seeing, you know, in the community seeing that kind of support, it had an impact on the jury. It had an impact on the prosecutor as well as the defense lawyers. And so, therefore, you know, the kind of gung-ho kind of attitude that normally permeates the prosecutor's office wasn't there when he saw all that support. And then you had superimposed upon that is a large number of people in the community support them, brothers and sisters. The implication being that if you convict them for this bogus crime, then you're going to have some real problems. And it does have an impact on the judicial process. But this is important. This is why support for movements is important. Now, again, it's a question in terms of being able to facilitate the kind of information, the kind of knowledge to people. There is no silver bullet until you simply got to do it. But I want to talk briefly about the level of adverse socialization impact on our people. One of the things is that I remember, you know, back in the day when I was in school, there was the sociology class. And it was interesting because there were three types of ways to be family. There was one with the socially equivalent, socially deviant, and socially variant. Socially deviant was meaning that these families are not like white families. Social variant means that families can exist in a different context. Social equivalent means they're just like white families. Well, they did a poll, and a lot of Africans actually said if the African family structure was socially deviant. What does that say in terms of how do you see yourself? See, this is the problem that we're confronted with. When people say that, you know what, you're doing too much talking in terms of the problem, we want to see more action. The question is, you can't act in isolation. That's what they have to understand. If individuals act in isolation, then they end up isolated, which means that there's no support, which means that they're painted as criminals, and any type of value that may be attained as a result of any type of political action is undermined by the state, who simply portrays the person as a criminal or some kind of a lone nut. So this is the problem in terms of doing things in isolation and why you have the support. But again, the question in terms of support is one of education. And the only thing we can do is continue to talk until people, it resonates with people and they begin to understand. I think also, to a large extent, as society continues to deteriorate, I think more and more people are confronted with the reality that this is not what they think it is. But right now, they're pretty much comfortable with the illusion that, you know, that this is the best possible thing of all worlds. So, therefore, they're not likely to support anything in a political nature or anything that's critical, anything that questions government or the things that go on. So this is the problem that we're confronted with. But so the issue is one of education. There's no other way around it.
Speaking of education, I'm going to share a scenario with the panel this evening, and I'd just like to get a response from y'all. I read an article recently on Temple University where they had a research project where they paid two professors, Salma Hakeem and Erwin Blackstone. Two professors at Temple University had to do a report on private prisons, the benefit of private prisons, and how it benefits the society and benefits government. they came up with a finding that private prisons are better for society because they save government money. That was the essence of their report. So they're trying to share this to the community that private prisons is a good thing. Now, it came out later on that the three major corporations that own private prisons are your Corrections Corporation of America, they call it CCA, your GEO Group, and you have another one called Management Training Corps, MTC. They are your three major private corporations that own and be a private prisons. They were the ones that funded the research. They're the ones who paid the professors. And they never revealed that information, that connection. And they found out later on, as a result of that, because of that, there were many flawed analysis that was in the report. But unfortunately, the report was already submitted to the school and to the public, and they used that to sway the politicians to build more private prisons. What can we do to make sure those kind of incidents will not occur in the future as it relates to what's in the best interest of how to govern our people as it relates to the criminal justice system? How do you deal with these kind of contradictions where money is running everything behind the scene and you don't know what to trust and who to believe? Brother Anthony, Brother Mayor, then Brother Aki.
Okay. I think, people have to learn how to look at everything with a critical eye. I'm glad you brought that article up, Brother Africa. I read it earlier, and it speaks to the level of corruption that exists in our community. Now, even though we're the victims of it, unfortunately, there are some people that benefit from our suffering among us. And, that's where it's a classic neocolonial situation. And unfortunately, these professors, they benefited in some way from putting out, this material, primarily from a financial standpoint. And unfortunately, because we're disorganized, we don't control the education of our people, and you get a lot of people that have very corrupt ideas because they think like the ruling class, which is what the education system is designed to do, to make you think like the bourgeoisie, even if it's against your own interests. And I think that article that you raised is is a good example of that. And we, in addition to education, we have to increase our level of organization.
Brother Mayo?
Yeah, this I saw a notice about this happening. It looks like there is some leverage when universities are so involved in these kinds of studies and attempt to give the clean bill of health or at least a cover of university objectivity and scholarly pursuit to these kinds of things. The problem is the universities, many of them have been doing this kind of thing for a long time, especially with regard to military research. And accepting contracts from the Pentagon and from private corporate entities engaged in the development of military hardware, tactics, and the like, for the purposes of greater military domination by the U.S. in the world. So this kind of thing has been going on, and has been. Not a great deal of opposition, continued strong opposition to it. But now it looks like that people have at least jumped to respond to this situation in a way that they have really gone after the ethical emphasis here, and it seemed to be getting some reaction and some response, according to the links and the other articles about this discovery of this thing. It's pretty blatant. It's not not very complex. It's just a pretty straightforward attempt at lying and attempt to support a situation that is unsupportable. But again, people have to be made aware of it, and people have to be organized to do that, to make others aware and to take action, to push the buttons, was legislative or otherwise, but certainly put the pressure on these universities, reveal them to be less than the kinds of objective scholarly institutions that deserve respect and honor when they are engaged in these kinds of activities. So it's just that kind of fight. It's taking it to the street in a way, the same time that you take it to the agencies and organizations that are supposed to be involved with ethics and legality. So it's just another fight that needs to be intensified, another front of the fight.
Okay, Brother Haki.
Well, I don't know how you're gonna stop the corruption. At the very minimum, you can at least respond to it, and certainly you can pressure the university to the extent that your displeasure with this kind of dirty dealing as maybe to discourage them from doing that in the future. First, let me just say, to be very candid about it, I'm not sure you're going to totally be able to liquidate the corruption at all. I think even if we pressure the schools, to censor these particular professors, I think they'll find very ingenious kinds of ways to do the exact same thing, because it's all about the money. And this is what our people have to understand. This is about the money. There is no honesty. There's no justice. There's no fairness. There's no integrity. It's only money. Everything's expedient, and it's all about the bucks. Certainly, one of the things that would help is, in fact, people like this, if they understood that at least we had a cohesive community, to the very least, to shame them, may have some impact in terms of at least minimizing the kind of corrupt mindset that exists in academia. But short of that, I'm not sure there's any much we can do in terms of eradicating corruption, because it's built into the system. The whole system is corrupt. And this is why people have to understand this. And if we can't work together, if we can't build institutions, first and foremost, to change the way our children think, if we can't build institutions to get our people to begin to critically to work together, then what chance do we have in terms of corruption? We either fight the corruption or we become part of the corruption. And so this is a fundamental problem that we're going to find it with. So the struggle is to fight corruption, but we need enlightened minds in order to do that.
Okay, like to alert our listening audience that last week we said we'll try to find the information on how you can contact or write our brother Jamil Alameen. I'd like to share that with our audience now, and then we'll come back, and we'd like to talk a little bit about other political prisoners. We have an open floor with our panelists on other political prisoners. I'd just talk a little bit about them, if we can. You can write Iman Jamil Abdullah Al Alameen, number 99974-555. Under that, you put ADAMX, address 5880 HWY 67 South. Next slide, Florence, Colorado. Zip code 81226. We'd like to encourage our listening audience to write the brother, write the state, tell him, release him, give him his medical treatment, and let him go home. He did nothing. He should die. We'll make a transition with some sense of dignity if he's really, really sick. And there are no need to treat him something less than an animal. Matter of fact, speaking of that, I found it really ironic, and I don't understand, and I'd like to just briefly have a discussion on this question of how humans treat human beings and they value human beings, and how some humans have more value for animals, i.e. the animal rights. Can anybody make any sense to me in terms of why we put more value in animals' rights than we do human beings? It's an open question for the panel. Who would like to respond to that?
I'll take a stab at it. I think that sentiment is rooted in U.S. history. Let's see, during the days of chattel slavery, Africans were regarded as animals. I mean, it's a rather crazy logic because there were some who were engaged with sexual relations. So, it's never made that much sense to me. But there are some people that have a higher regard for animals, like dogs or cats, than they do for human beings. And just a really crazy thought process that exists in this society. And but it goes back to that time period where the European ruling class generally regarded Africans as subhuman. And they used that rationale to justify exploiting our labor. And so, unfortunately, that sentiment, continues to this day among some.
Anyone else like to respond to that?
Well, I can't understand it. I can't even begin to understand that paradigm. One of the things is when I ask, these dog lovers, why don't you exhibit the same kind of compassion and concern for human babies? Well, the response is that we do. I say yes, but I never see it in papers. I never see it on television. I certainly never see it online, and this kind of exuberance when it comes to human babies. But when it comes to dogs, then you rally by the thousands. Michael Vick had a trial in Virginia, in Richmond. There was so many dog lovers. I mean, they literally blocked the streets. I mean, they were out there for dogs. That same week, they had a little 3-year-old that was ruthlessly beat to death, and not a word. So I do understand to some extent the media's complicity in terms of not, conveying the importance in terms of human life. But it seems to me that when we talk about animals, even without media input, these people seem to be very organized when it comes to a damn dog. So I'm hard-pressed to even understand that. I really can't understand it. And none of them can clarify for me exactly what this exuberance is all about and why it's not demonstrated when it comes to human babies. It's something that even to this day, perplexed me. I really don't understand it. And I continue to ask them whenever I run into them, what is that? Why is that? Is there some rationale for this? Can you explain it to me? Because I don't understand it. So to me, it's out of the ordinary, and I don't understand it.
Let me hazard a stab at this. A couple of things that involved, I think, and one of them, of course, is the business aspect of it, and the entire business of animal care and maintenance, the pets in particular in the U.S., and that has a very positive meaning to mainstream U.S. Culture. And the other is that it serves as a kind of psychological support for the humanitarian claims of the public. humanitarian in this sense, using the animal to show that the person is a loving, caring human being, so much so as to devote that care and lovingness to the creatures who cannot even speak, et cetera, et cetera. So at the same time, these persons are part of a culture and part of a history that is among the most vicious and violent in the world against other human beings, but that can be balanced, as it were, psychologically and socially against being such a lover and in tune with others of like minds who protect these defenseless creatures, domestic and wild. So I think there's some projection of something, an attempt to cover up something in this extreme. I myself have had pets, dogs, cats, and have a feeling for other creatures, wild and domestic, and I understand that there is some natural, affinity for that in most people. But this stuff has gone way beyond. It's very excessive, and the excessiveness of it is what I'm speaking about. And that's, I think, what we're all speaking about, this kind of thing. So that's as much as I can surmise about it. That's my feeling and my thought about it.
Jabari?
Your question, please.
I'm trying to understand this logic where human beings have more of a feeling for animal rights than people to human rights. Where does that come from?
Well,
if
I was to attempt to rationalize such an irrational thought pattern, I guess what would be some sense of sometimes we all need to escape from reality, so we use this opportunity to bond with animals, pets, if you will, to have that sense of belonging, that sense of affection that we might not necessarily get from fellow human beings for one reason or another.
Okay, no problem. I just want to understand if this makes sense to me. I've been winding down to our final minutes of the program, and we're doing this particular program, talking at and dealing with political prisons inside and outside the United States. And I will ask each one of y'all to take a few minutes and just talk about, or if you had to say something to all the political prisoners, what kind of encouragement, what is it that you'd like to say to them? Brother Hakeem.
Well, I think I would, first of all, thank the brothers, for their selfless acts in terms of their commitment to humanity, commitment to the people, commitment to the community. I would talk a little bit about in terms of what they meant to me as an individual in terms of shaping my life, in terms of, striving, to do that which is right, even though while not popular, doing that which is right. So I think I would talk a little bit about terms of their impact on me, as a young man growing up. But that's probably the things I would most talk to them about in terms of, if I met them, So, and I did get an opportunity to meet Jamil Alameen when he was, many, many years ago down in Georgia. I met Taruba Ben Wahar, had the opportunity to talk to him, but after 19 years, I had a nice discussion with him around, what he sees in terms of, real legitimate change to society. And so I did thank the brother, for his contributions to humanity and, struggle against injustice, and so that's basically what I would say to him if I met him on face to face.
Brother Anthony?
I would express to the brothers and the sisters who were and are political prisoners our gratitude for the contribution that they made to our people's struggle. And that even though it may not seem to be appreciated in the present, future generations will remember the contributions you made to our struggle for freedom. And that would be the most important thing I would convey to them, that we thank you for the contribution you made to our liberation struggle.
Brother Mayo?
Yes, thank you. It's first and foremost, thank you. And then to ask of them what is it they need that we might pursue immediately, what can we do or try to do for them now and as well as the short run, and to inform them of those things that they might not know about that may be being attempted in their behalf. And again, thank you, brother and or sister, for your struggle and for hanging in there for us.
Brother Zabari?
First and foremost, as the other brothers have said, you got to express a sense of gratitude for their struggle. And you also can thank them for being an inspiration, because you never know where someone finds out about the story and is motivated to continue the pursuit of justice and equality for everybody.
And we have our Sister Hattie still online. We'd like to get your final thoughts. What would you say to them, Sister Hattie?
I say stay strong and be brave.
Okay, we'd like to thank all of y'all and thank the listening audience for allowing us to come to their homes today as we discuss political prisoners inside and outside America. We know that for our listening audience, I'd like for you to chart this down. There's a list of many, many, many political prisoners inside of the U.S., and we'd like to send you to MumiaAbuJamal.com/list, L-I-S-T, -U-S-political-prisoners/. It's an excellent list of political prisoners where you can find out more about them, maybe adopt one, communicate with them, because remember, human beings are social beings. It's important that we socialize with each other, because when we stop socializing with each other, we stop becoming a human. So it's very important not to leave our freedom fighters isolated. Until next time, we thank you again. Let's strive forward. Let's struggle. Let's struggle. Let's struggle. Let's struggle until to the end. Because through struggle, there's progress. We can guarantee you to struggle. You will get victory. You will get victory. And the best way to get victory is to arm yourself with information and organization. Those are the weapons for the oppressed. And to the political prisoners, hang in there. We with you. You are not alone. Again, this has been Brother Africa. We thank everybody, and we'll take you out with Bob Marley. Oh, my.